Remember all those times I said in this space, on this program, that this economy is on its own? Congressional inaction has consequences. That is the moral of this story. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today. This one is the 17th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It is possible, we know, to hold two or more contradictory facts in your mind at the same time. For instance, it is a fact that altogether, almost 1.5 million people made new claims for unemployment benefits last week. It is also a fact that the day after Christmas, millions more people will lose federal pandemic jobless benefits. And it is further a fact that Congress, which is to say Senate Republicans, for months have not been able to agree that more government help for this economy is necessary. Now that backs are against the wall, though, it seems likely some kind of relief package might pass, probably something just under $1 trillion. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, there is still a real and increasing risk that the recovery from this recession is going to be slower and longer and more painful than it had to be.
COVID surging, layoffs are rising, consumers are hunkering down. Not a great place to be heading into 2021. Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics says the $900 billion Congress is considering spending to get the economy moving in the right direction is only a down payment on recovery.
This relief package is about avoiding going deeper into the economic hole. You know, without it, I do think we will go back into recession. So this is about avoiding that. It's not really about jumpstarting the economy.
And without more stimulus spending, especially to shore up state and local government budgets, Heidi Shierholz at the Economic Policy Institute says the economy is backsliding.
We've already seen more than 1 million jobs lost in state and local government. When you have teachers and firefighters who lose their jobs so they no longer have income, they aren't spending money in the private sector, and so more people lose their jobs.
Zandi's hope is, by the middle of next year, as vaccination spreads and the consumer economy starts to reopen on a post-pandemic footing, that Congress will pass a much bigger, more robust stimulus bill.
Infrastructure spending would generate lots of jobs for all of the folks that have lost their jobs permanently and to try to get the economy back to full employment more quickly.
If that doesn't happen, well, we've seen this movie before. Heidi Shierholz says after the Great Recession, Congress pulled back on stimulus spending too much, too early.
What they're doing now is way better than nothing, but it's not enough. And I do worry about we're really setting this up to be another long, slow recovery.
That recovery to full employment took 7 to 8 years. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Two more contradictory fact sets before we go on here. Number one, more than 3,600 Americans died of COVID yesterday. More than 245,000 new cases were reported, both of those record highs. And number two, the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 hit record highs today, too. Details, numbers, when we get there. Mitchell mentioned the $300 a week in extra unemployment benefits that is said to be in the relief bill Congress is said to be talking about. Not often mentioned, given how much we've been talking about unemployment insurance since this pandemic hit, is that our unemployment system is 85 years old and hasn't seen a major reform since Gerald Ford was in the White House. Catherine Edwards studies unemployment insurance at RAND, and given how critical it is, that is to say unemployment insurance is in this economy right now, we thought it might be a good idea to talk. Dr. Edwards, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
So when the economy started going south back in late February, early March, and those of us who don't study the labor market and unemployment saw the crater that was happening, I think a lot of people were caught unawares. Were you surprised at all that the unemployment system sort of got overwhelmed?
No, because the problems with the system have been known for decades. The real weakness in unemployment insurance is that the people who finance the program and the people who administer the program are better off when fewer people receive benefits, right? Your state has to finance a tax on its employer base in order to pay for benefits. And states don't like doing this. Mm. You know, I mean, you can imagine the Amazon headquarters search. They said one of the components of their process would be what the employer tax was in the state. Mm. When Congress saw that a recession was coming, it knew exactly what it had to fix. And they did it. They did it all in the single legislation. Unfortunately, they had it all expire.
Right. Which gets us to the current moment where there is so much peril as Congress decides what it's going to do.
Yes. I often joke with my friends that perhaps Congress just has a flair for high drama, which is why they keep on establishing benefits in the middle of recession and then threatening to take them away, but possibly extending. It's not a very fair thing to do for the families who are relying so entirely on these benefits because there is no job to be found.
Right. How much of the, well, I'm going to say dysfunction, you may disagree because arguably it's working, but how much of the dysfunction of the unemployment insurance program is because it's kind of a state and federal hybrid?
I would argue, especially in terms of fraud, it's most of it. But on the benefit side, when you allow benefits to vary across state, you create a wedge between what someone earned and what they get in a benefit, right? So if I were to apply for Social Security old age insurance tomorrow, and I found out that because I lived in Texas, I got half of what I would have gotten had I lived in Oklahoma, right? People would be incredibly upset. And they wouldn't be able to believe that this benefit that you paid for and worked for is ultimately going to be filtered through what your state feels is worthy, right? It should be based on you. We do that for old age insurance, but we don't do that for unemployment insurance.
Yeah. So given that on the one hand, we tried to reform or fix the unemployment insurance system in this country several times over the past five decades. But on the other hand, we saw Congress in March work unbelievably quickly to shovel trillions of dollars out the door when it was desperately needed in unemployment and business support. What's your confidence level in finally being able to rectify the wrongs?
You know, the question you're asking me is, have we reached a turning point? One thing that the CARES Act included that I thought was pretty incredible was that it added to the reasons for unemployment insurance, caring for another person, caring for someone who had COVID or caring for school children that had no other option. So my hope would be that we would act boldly and broadly in thinking not just here's this program that's joint state that has eroded benefits, but we have an economy that has risk that workers are exposed to that we should cover efficiently because that's the best investment for the economy.
Dr. Catherine Edwards at RAND. Catherine, thanks for your time. I appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you so much, Kai.
A story now about the streaming ecosystem. You've got the streaming services, the HBO Maxes, the Netflixes, the Apple TV Pluses, and then you got the devices, phones and tablets, sure. Increasingly, TVs themselves can stream directly. And then you've got the boxes and the gizmos, the Fire TVs, and today, for us, Roku, which has just made a deal with HBO Max, which comes just in time for the much-anticipated launch of Wonder Woman 1984 Christmas Day. The takeaway? This business isn't really in the little black box itself. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab explains.
The streaming industry is growing fast, so fast that no single system has a deal with every app. So consumers are stuck buying multiple systems that, in theory, all do the same thing.
You're going to see a lot more of that confusion in the months ahead because it's really now the programmers and these new operating systems that have to agree with each other in order to enable delivery.
Tim Hanlon is CEO of the Vertair Group. He says things will feel more streamlined once customers replace their old TVs with smart TVs. Until then, they need Roku or Amazon Fire TV Stick to bridge the gap. A Roku starts at $29.99, cheap enough for the company to sell lots of them. But, says Dan Rayburn at research firm Frost & Sullivan,
that's not where they're making the vast majority of their revenue, and the margins on that are very slim.
Roku makes about 70% of its revenue from deals with brands like HBO by taking a cut from subscriptions and ad revenue, which means Roku is only as good as its content.
New content, fresh content, original content. Content has always been king.
That doesn't mean content makers hold all the cards. Roku is the biggest player in the streaming device market. Emily Grosch is an analyst at Mintel.
I think the biggest advantage is absolutely the number of eyeballs, the opportunity to actually drive subscriptions on that platform.
And with Roku software embedded in lots of smart TVs, the company may evolve, but isn't going anywhere anytime soon. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's red and green. It's very bright. And it has a polar bear wearing a scarf that's actually like a tie.
Ah, the ugly Christmas sweater. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 148 today. That's almost a half percent, 30,303, which is, I think, a palindrome. I can't do it on the fly. I don't know. The Nasdaq gained 106 points, 0.8%, 12,764. The S&P 500 picked up 21 points. Almost 0.6%, 37.22. A sidebar here to Kristen's piece about Roku. It is the most popular, as she said, of what are known as over-the-top or OTT streaming devices. That's according to Deutsche Bank. About 43% of consumers who own OTT devices say they own at least one Roku. Shares, by the way, up 0.1%. Amazon down about 0.1% today. The drugstore chain Rite Aid reported strong third quarter and boosted its sales revenue and profit targets. Shares thus shot up more than 17%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose 0.93%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have come to that point in 2020 where comparisons can be made between a life-saving global immunization program and weird frozen ice cream balls. Maddie Bender wrote about Dippin' Dots and corona vaccines for Popular Science. Maddie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kai. Thanks for having me.
So look, for those who are unfamiliar, what are Dippin' Dots?
Well, Dippin' Dots are essentially ice cream, but much, much colder. They're these little round pelletized dots that melt in your mouth when you eat them. And they were actually invented by a microbiologist who was initially working on animal feed thought, why don't I apply this same technology to ice cream to create a unique product?
Wow. I don't know if I'd have gone from animal feed to ice cream, but okay. But anyway, so the similarity here, the joint point between these vaccines and this ice cream-like substance, and I say that just because I've had them and they're a little odd, is the extreme cold temperature, right? Explain that a little bit.
Completely. So because of how Dippin' Dots are created, which is they're put in liquid nitrogen and made super, super cold, you need to keep them at a very cold temperature. These vaccines, the ones produced by Pfizer and Moderna, also have to be kept at a super cold temperature. Because of that, both Dippin' Dots and now these vaccine distributors have had to create what's called a cold chain.
Right. So let's dig into that a little bit, because that's the, you know, logistics and marketplace slice of these things. Dippin' Dots is manufactured here in California, sold at baseball stadiums and sports arenas and everywhere else around the country. They have to keep them cold. They do it with dry ice, much like these manufacturers of vaccines are going to have to do, right?
Yeah. So Dippin' Dots needs to be stored at least at negative 49 degrees Fahrenheit. But it's not an easy process. Dry ice can be dangerous. You need to wear gloves when you're handling it because it can cause burns. And then in addition, it can go quickly from solid to gas form and take up the space that oxygen normally would.
Right, which is why the FAA had to grant special waivers for airplanes. Obviously, it becomes a problem in an enclosed space like an airplane. But the thing that hit me out of this article was that dry ice does not last necessarily forever. And approximately like once every 5 days, as these Dippin' Dots are en route, they have to sometimes be met by additional dry ice refrigeration. And so one imagines vaccines might have that same dilemma.
Exactly. Pfizer's actually said that their vaccine can be stored in the containers they put them in, called pizza trays, just because that's what they look like, mm-hmm. for up to 30 days. But you need to come in and restock it with dry ice every 5 days. And that presents an additional logistical challenge for the people shipping out and distributing these vaccines.
Did you look at all these vaccine stories and say, hey, wait a minute, Dippin' Dots is the exact same thing, except, you know, ice cream instead of vaccines?
It actually came up. So I'm in public health school right now, and we were talking about cold chain logistics. And someone brought up, hey, wait a second, doesn't Dippin' Dots also have to be super cold? And that made a lot of sense to me, because growing up, you'd always see Dippin' Dots at kind of these random places, mm-hmm. so amusement parks and sports stadiums, but you couldn't find them at your local grocery store.
Now, have you ever had Dippin' Dots?
I have.
What do you think? I'm on the record in this interview as thinking they're kind of weird. What do you think?
I also think they're kind of weird. There's someone described it in a tweet as chewy, which I think that kind of is the mouthfeel. I do like the cookie dough flavor, though.
Oh, man. Well, you can't go wrong with cookie dough. Maddie Bender writing in Popular Science about the cold chain for Dippin' Dots and what that has to do with life-saving global vaccine preparation. Maddie, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
At some point reasonably early on in his presidency, Joe Biden is going to have to figure out how he wants to handle China. The Trump administration leaves him with an ongoing, although largely forgotten, trade war, a phase one trade deal that mostly has not delivered, unresolved questions on market access, intellectual property protections, forced technology transfers, the list goes on. In the meanwhile, China has joined a regional trade agreement with 14 other countries in Asia, of which the United States is notably not a part. China has the second biggest economy in the world, so it's tough not to do business there. So, marketplaces of Brie Benishore looked at some of the Biden administration's options.
The toolbox when it comes to China is missing a few things.
One really useful option of confronting China has been taken away, and that is to be able to use the World Trade Organization to be able to, you know, bring cases against China.
Chad Bown is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
For the previous 10, 12 years, that had been the approach. And virtually every time one of those disputes was brought forward, and there, you know, were two dozen or so of these the United States brought against China, the United States would win the case, and China, for the most part, would fix the underlying problem.
But the Trump administration blocked judges from joining the bench. They're basically shutting down the ability of the WTO to settle trade cases. The Biden administration could reverse that. Then again, even when the WTO was functional, it didn't really put a stop to one of the U.S.'s major complaints with China, subsidies. Nick Lardy is also with the Peterson Institute.
The rules on subsidies are vague, and as a result, there have not been very many cases dealing with subsidies.
Plus, when countries sue each other over everything from airplane subsidies to unfair dumping of products, the cases can drag on for years, and by the time they're resolved, a lot of the economic damage has been done. There are, of course, tariffs, the favorite of the Trump administration. They already cover $350 billion worth of Chinese goods.
The tariffs have not induced any kind of positive change. And in fact, the evidence is they're hurting the U.S. economy.
David Dollar is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. While Trump's tariffs haven't produced structural change, they might afford President Biden at least some leverage for getting rid of them.
The smart thing would be to negotiate away the tariffs, which have not been very effective, in return for some clear progress on market access, intellectual property rights protection, forced technology transfer.
History suggests, though, that's easier said than done. Another strategy open to Biden, targeting specific Chinese firms on national security grounds. That was a favorite under the Trump administration.
I think the Biden administration is absolutely going to need that policy.
Amy Selico is a principal with Albright Stonebridge Group. If you say, no, this isn't a trade dispute, it's actually a national security issue, the president or country can gain a lot of legal leeway.
when it comes to the national security interests of the United States, having access to medical supplies, having access to rare earths that, as you know, are essential components in so many IT systems.
Trump blacklisted Chinese telecom company Huawei, tried to cut off its ability to benefit from U.S. technology, even going after Huawei's deals with governments abroad. Silico says this wasn't just because of national security concerns. The U.S. also views Huawei as having received unfair support from the Chinese government and having taken the intellectual property of its competitors. Blacklisting as a policy, though, can invite other problems. China can harass U.S. companies in return. There's one approach that fell out of favor under the Trump administration. Simple strength in numbers.
Start building a club of like-minded economies.
Again, Brookings' David Dollar. A lot of countries have the same issues with China as the U.S. does. Together, they could change the rules at the WTO, for example. And Dollar says the U.S. needs to build and rebuild ties with Asian countries and rejoin the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. That deal, negotiated under Obama and abandoned by Trump, doesn't include China and sets a high bar on issues like protecting intellectual property.
If we're creating a better set of rules for innovation and efficiency, then that's going to tend to win out as the home for important supply chains.
Whatever path the Biden administration treads, the reality is that China's economic clout keeps on growing, and none of the available tools is a silver bullet for managing the relationship between two economic superpowers. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
You can hear Sabri sometimes hosting the Marketplace Morning Report. Usually it's David Brancaccio getting out of bed early. Either way, check them out. Everything you need to know to start your business day. With the holiday season, usually come lots of parties and chances to buy fun holiday clothes. Festive ties, perhaps, glittery gowns. Behind all those clothes, though, are lots and lots of companies, sequin manufacturers and fabric suppliers and dressmakers. And this year, with in-person parties pretty much out of the question, it's a challenge. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
There's a company in New York City's garment district called Shine Trim. It sells elaborate embellishments, like sequined red bows and gold beads, to fashion designers and dressmakers.
And we also get a lot of people just coming in, you know, I'm going to a New Year's Eve party and I want to bling it out.
Owner Helen Lin says she's noticed something this year. Clothing makers are coming to her saying, I need to make my customer a really fancy blouse.
It's got to be all sequin and all crystal, and we want to do it so shiny.
But nothing for the waist down, because if you're going to a holiday party this year, it's probably on Zoom or FaceTime.
I've not heard anything about, like, I'm wearing these amazing pants that I need to get tons of rhinestone for.
The people who are buying fancy clothes for virtual parties are the exception. Lynn says sales are down by about half, and the company had to close one of its stores. Michael Londrigan is a professor at the Fashion Business College, LIM.
Holiday attire took a major hit this year.
He's actually going to a virtual holiday party for his college today. But he didn't buy anything new to wear, just pulled out an ugly sweater. His words, not mine.
It's red and green, it's very bright, and it has a polar bear who is wearing a scarf that's actually like a tie.
There is a possible silver lining here for the suppliers and makers of sparkly dresses and the like. David German owns AGH Trim Source in Manhattan, which sells about 4,000 kinds of decorative trim. He says his sales have dropped by at least half, but
I think there's a tremendous pent-up demand that we're going to see when the vaccine really gets this under control.
And once it's safe, he thinks people are really going to want to celebrate in person. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which you pay your money, you take your chances, and you can pay in Bitcoin if you like. Coinbase, which is the biggest U.S.-based exchange for cryptocurrencies, filed paperwork with the Securities and Exchange Commission today for an initial public offering. It would be the first major crypto company to do that in the next year, probably 2021. Here, though, is the caveat emptor portion of this item. Bitcoin topped $20,000 yesterday. That is per Bitcoin. The granddaddy of all cryptocurrencies has tripled in value this year. So you know, nothing speculative happening there at all. All right, we got to go, but here is your Thursday moment of economic context in which I channel my inner Amy Scott, and not for the first time this week, I think. For the 15th time this year, mortgage rates have hit a record low. You can borrow money for 30 years to buy a house in this economy right now and pay just 2.67% interest on average. A year ago, a still staggeringly low 3.73%. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.